So, Bat, when did you come to realize that you were a failure?
Let's get one thing perfectly straight here, baby cakes. I'm only here for one reason and one reason only.
The court ordered therapy. I know.
Yes.
So let's start at the beginning. Do you remember your first feelings of hostility?
The day the nurse in the maternity ward rebuffed my advances.
How old were you?
2 days old.
You don't really remember all that.
I was a lech from day one, bucko. You remember every statistic.
So, you were a failure.
In some areas, perhaps.
The collapse of your marriage. The end of your show.
Look, why should I have to pay to talk with you? I could be putting all this money to better therapeutic use.
Why don't you just write a book or something?
But that would involve effort and talent.
You've made it this far.
Some things are too good to be true.
Okay, so I'm here with Benjamin Anastas, who is most recently the author of Too Good to Be True. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm great, Edward.
So, there are a number of memoirs that are devoted to literary failures. I think of Paul Auster's Hand to Mouth. I think of Tom Grimes' Mentor. And I think that there's something about reading a book about literary failure that's kind of akin to looking at the mirror and sort of seeing the sagging and aging body and so forth. This leads me to ask what it must feel like to write such a thing, to expose something that is so identified with books and so identified with failure in book form. I mean, how do you contend with the notion of shame or humiliation or just you have no shame?
Do I have no shame? Well, clearly I actually have no shame. Well, I think I never set out to write a memoir. I have always been kind of anti-memoir. In my writing life, I've written screeds against them. My first novel was—I thought of it as a kind of Russian tract against the memoir when I was writing it and publishing it. You know, I was very much influenced by Dostoevsky and Notes from Underground. You know, which was a response to—I don't remember the name of the tract, but it was a response to this contemporary political tract. So I was trying to use the novel with my first book. As an answer to what I thought then was the memoir craze, but of course the memoir craze has just sort of spread and metastasized, and we live in a kind of memoir society.
Yeah.
But anyway, I ended up writing the book honestly because I really had no other choice.
No other choice?
Well, seriously, I mean, I've been trying to write fiction for a long time, and I just hadn't been working. I would either abandon projects, you know, kind of 100 pages in, or I would just edit them to death, so there was really nothing there. And the circumstances of my life had gotten so bad that I couldn't really do the necessary work of imagining. You know, every time I sat down to write, all I could think about was, well, God, how am I going to pay the rent this month? Or, geez, is my girlfriend going to leave me because I'm so broke? Or, what am I going to do about my child support payment coming up on the 15th, you know? That's all financial stuff. But there was also just the sort of overwhelming sense of how did this happen to me, you know? How did I find myself here?
Did you feel that you were a victim and you need to sort of memorialize this notion of how did I get here? Was it come from a sense of victimhood, do you feel? Or
No, definitely not victimhood. I mean, what was really interesting to me was trying to figure out, you know, the book kind of moves in two directions simultaneously. The first is it moves forward in time, which I was literally writing in real time, kind of how am I going to get myself out of this mess? How am I going to find a job? How am I going to keep my girlfriend? Uh-huh. How am I going to keep on seeing my son as much as I want to?
So you weren't a fact checker at the beginning of the writing?
No, I wasn't. You know, I started writing the book in the fall of 2010, and I was just about to hit financial rock bottom. And you know, it was the kind of situation where people had stopped answering my emails. You know, the kind of things that I had done to make money had all sort of disappeared.
You weren't led past the velvet rope in any form.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Huh. So why did you feel that? I guess you felt the need to grapple to the closest reality at hand, and that was the only way to actually deal with it. I mean, there's actually one line where you say, how much of our lives do we write and how much of them are written for us? And I'm wondering, you know, why you feel life has to be measured by how it is documented or how it is written about or how it is chronicled, and how this was a way for you to deal with this really sordid rock bottom existence that is there at the very beginning of the book. Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it's funny. I use the phrase write. You know, how much of our lives do we get to write? Of course, that's how I think about life because I am a writer.
Yeah.
But I really kind of meant that metaphorically in the sense that how much of our own lives do we get to control? How much agency do we have? And how much of it is stuff that we've inherited? So, there were two things simultaneously happening in the book. The first is I'm trying to figure my way out of this mess and actually find work and try to sort of keep my relationship alive and keep my relationship with my son alive. And also at the same time, try to restore my relationship to writing by going into my son's room with a notebook every day with it and a pen, just sort of writing this book or the pages that sort of began this book, writing them out in longhand. And the second thing I was trying to do was kind of go back in time, all the way back to the beginning, to my first memories, to try to sort of figure out, how much of where I find myself is due to experiences that I had when I was young.
Yeah.
How much of it can be traced to these sort of formative experiences I had when I was 3 years old, including sort of the really bad childhood therapy, which gives the book its title.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I. More than assigning blame, more than claiming victimhood for myself, it's a way of trying to create connections to sort of find where the symmetry is, because I did feel like my life was weirdly symmetrical, like I had been returned to the state that was very much like my earliest beginnings.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you view your life from this image of premonition throughout the book, the idea of this sedan that's running into a tree, which then starts to have applicability to other incidents later on. I mean, it's almost as, I mean, but on the other hand, or even like, I lost my marriage going down a glass elevator. I mean,
right.
There is a sense of personal responsibility we all have that we can, in fact, take action to, if not inform that premonition, but to also throw a few curveballs at the inevitable. I mean,
sure,
why do you
sure.
sort of seem to default, at least in this book, towards the premonitory or my life has this trajectory that it's just going to play out this way?
Well, because I think that I was trying to sort of trace the moments of symmetry and kind of put the pieces of this life that had been broken up into large pieces that were kind of dangling all over the apartment and you know, hung over the railing and all this kind of stuff, and kind of I wanted to try to sort of put it all together and figure out how I got to this place in life. And to me, that's being active. That's not sort of being passive and saying, oh, life has done these things to me. I haven't been an equal partner in this. It's saying like, oh, life, how could you, you know?
Yeah.
It's not really, it's to me, that feeling never really entered into it. It was more a sense of taking what I do have, which is a knowledge of writing, a knowledge of books, and, you know, some measure of talent, and trying to use those to kind of knit back together a life that had broken to pieces. Yeah.
It's fascinating to me that you couldn't actually approach this dilemma through fiction, or that it was difficult. You said that you were writing fiction that was too edited. Did you just really need to have an extremely broken place with which to just turn out something as a writer? What is the difference between fiction and nonfiction to you? I'm really curious about this. Why can't you approach fiction in the same way that you approach nonfiction, which is like, here I am, I'm kind of responding to the broken place I'm in, but I'm going to sort of write my way out of it, you know?
Right. Well, that's what I've been able to do. That's what I had been able to do my entire writing life, you know, up until the last 4 or 5 years. Obviously your life informs your fiction, even if the characters you're writing about and the time they live in has nothing to do with kind of where you are. You know, that you always have some kind of overwhelming feeling that you're trying to capture, and the feeling often comes from your immediate set of circumstances. You just lend it to somebody else, you know? But I think just because of the dire state of my circumstances and because of the ways I'd failed as a fiction writer over the past 5 years, I just couldn't do it anymore. And I had to, with this book anyway, I had to kind of write it straight. It was a reality experiment. I was writing about things as they were happening, which was incredibly rewarding in a lot of ways. But it was also just, I could get the immediate satisfaction of, you know, if I'd had this sort of bizarre experience at the Brooklyn flea market, and this very overwhelming sense of, oh my God, here's this life here in Brooklyn that I'm trying to be a part of, but I just can't somehow make it happen. And I could lose it all, even the things that I do have, I could lose them all in a second. I wanted to, it was so immediate to me and so profound that I wanted to write about it kind of immediately after the fact. And there was some lag time built in. I mean, I think I wrote about the flea market kind of 2 months after I had been there.
Well, I mean, I relate to the Brooklyn flea concerns myself, but on the other hand, I would argue, well, if you can't afford the overpriced stuff that they have there, why not just go to the flea markets in South Brooklyn, which is what the rest of us schmoes do, because there's actually like a sense of wonder, I guess, down there, and we try to find what's left of that old school flea market pre-gentrification experience. There are other factors, kids and so forth, but on the other hand, you know, it's interesting how you have to go to this area of Brooklyn and have to stay in
That's where I lived. Yeah, it's where I lived, and it was the illusion I was trying to maintain.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of the book is trying to no longer, it's just saying, like, forget about maintaining the illusion. You know, forget about trying to be too good to be too. Forget about trying to have the perfect Brooklyn life.
Yeah.
Because it's, you can only kind of have the life that you can afford.
Yeah.
You know. And it's just stop trying to pretend. You know.
Why do you think you were so resistant to the regrettable forces of change in Brooklyn? I mean, why couldn't you actually stare it in the face and say, oh my God, like, everything that I knew both professionally and everything I also know geographically is shifting in front of my eyes. I mean, it all depends. Some people can adapt to these changes, some people cannot. Why do you think that you were sort of stilted for a long time into these changes?
I'm slow to adapt, you know? I think I just sort of tend to be locked in my head, like a lot of writers.
Yeah.
And even as I'm using the personal pronoun I an awful lot, which is funny because as a memoirist, I guess you sort of have to, but...
Well, you actually do have a number of yous as well in this book. So,
it's true. You know, I've been in New York long enough to have lived in neighborhoods that underwent profound changes. And, you know, I lived in Williamsburg from 1993 until 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
And then I went away to Italy. But I saw Williamsburg changing before my eyes, and it was really only sort of the tail end of it that I thought, like, oh my God, I can't be here anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So I think because most of my concern every day is sort of like, do I have a roof over my head? Do I have enough to eat? Am I getting my work done?
Yeah.
I think there's a certain sense when you're a writer that you need to close off the world around you in order just to get your work done.
Yeah.
So I think these kind of profound changes can go on without, in some ways, without you noticing. Even though your job is to be a noticer as a writer, your job is to notice.
So the big change, the big factors that were preventing you from doing your writing, it seems to me, were just an acute consciousness of being impoverished, of trying to stay alive, trying to stay afloat. I mean, why do you think, like, I mean, some other writers, either by having, you know, partners who support them or by just not giving a damn and letting themselves go into credit card debt. I've seen that too. And then they wake up a year later and they see, oh my God, I can't believe that. they're able to at least believe in the illusion of their project so that they can still write.
Right.
At what point did you stop believing in that illusion? And I mean, it seems like at the 4 to 5 years ago, were you having difficulty?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, I think I had believed in there is a certain element of kind of gambling when you're a writer, which is like, yeah, I'm gonna take on credit card debt. I'm gonna let all these other areas of my life just sort of lie fallow while I'm finishing the project. And then when I'm done, you know, I'll get the big payoff or some kind of payoff. I kind of lost the, I lost the ability to do that after what I went through with my third novel, which is that, you know, I spent 3 or 4 years working on this book, and then it wasn't published in the U.S. It was only published in Europe. So, in a way, I'd kind of lost my right to. It felt to me like to even sort of claim I was a writer, to say like, oh, okay, yes, I'm going to credit card debt, but at the end of this 2 or 3 year period, something really good will happen, and I'll be back again. But I kind of lost the right to do that because I didn't know. I mean, I was no longer certain.
Uh huh.
You know, not that there's ever any certainty as a writer, but sure. I really had lost whatever little certainty I had.
The one thing we really don't talk about is the life of a writer. I mean, there's a great stigma attached to the realities of, like, well, you're going to get, like, if you're lucky, maybe a $10,000 advance on something that you spent 3 years on.
Right.
And you sort of address this in the Frankfurt chapters,
right,
where you're standing in the middle of this ring, and it's this sort of crushing sight because, of course, Muhammad Ali is much bigger than you are.
It wasn't so much that, it was just sort of standing in, I just remember such a vivid feeling of standing in that empty ring that I didn't know at the time it was waiting for Muhammad Ali to show up. But it was an idea not only that what publishing really wants is Muhammad Ali, but it was also that, you know,
especially now with Penguin.
Now
there was an announcement this morning that it may be Harper or News Corp was interested in possibly
really?
Purchasing Joining Penguin.
In?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. So it's either going to be Random or Penguin, and so Random or Harper, perhaps. You know,
that's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
It's funny. I did. You know, one of my regrets. The life of a writer is just filled with regrets. But anyway, one of my regrets. I was supposed to write an article for The Atlantic on why I'm publishing with Amazon, but I had some medical stuff that got in the way, so I couldn't do it. But I talked to some really interesting people, one of whom was Jason Epstein, and one of the things he said to me during this interview was almost uncanny. He said, like, what are they going to do, keep on getting bigger?
Yeah.
And here they are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, But going back to the stigma, I mean, we why do you think there's this stigma for, like, well, we can't talk about the hardships that writers go through?
Well, to be honest, people don't care about the hardships that writers go through, and yeah. I don't think they really should either, because it's self-inflicted, you know,
yeah.
For the most part. It took me a long time to kind of get out of the mindset that I was somehow special. But, you know, all it took was getting an office job, and I was, oh, I actually should have been doing this all along.
Yeah. But wait a minute. So you say that we shouldn't really chronicle the hardships, yet here you have in this book, you know?
Well, I think the hardships of a writer in and of themselves aren't necessarily significant. But if you go through, like I've done, and kind of connect it to kind of episodes in early life, having parents who are you know, anti-consumerist and countercultural in a lot of ways. And I think sort of that's my inheritance. And I think the whole question of kind of what we inherit from our parents and what we end up doing with it in our own lives, like that's much more universally applicable, you know? That's something that every single person in the world grapples with. What have my parents given me, and what am I going to make out of it, you know? So then I think the particulars, which is sort of, it really sucks being a writer, the particulars become less important.
Yeah. So going back to this issue of, he's okay. Going back to this issue of ego and stigma, I mean, how much of this dilemma of, well, I may get something back from my efforts to being in Frankfurt, this literary conflicting position led to this act of infidelity? I mean, you talk about inevitability, you talk about premonitions, and this seems to happen because you're almost waiting around, almost capitulating entirely to the premonitory. So, you know, how much of that went into that particular mistake?
I mean, you know, I make it clear that I made a choice. You know, there was getting on the glass elevator with Francesca, or there was not. So it was definitely a choice. But I think a lot of it did have to do with the failure of my book and being at the book fair surrounded by so much product, by so many books in the world, and thinking to yourself, like, I mean, there are, you know, these massive towers when you go into the German pavilion of just all these, you know, like Jonathan Franzen's head is like 10 feet high.
Yes.
You know? Jeffrey Eugenides has like entire walls devoted to his output, you know? And the idea that the idea that you can still be trying after as many years as I had been writing at that point, you can still be trying to sort of break your way in. There can still be no guarantee.
Yeah.
You can spend 3 or 4 years writing a book, and there's still no guarantee that it's going to be kind of sucked up into this great machinery and find its way into this trade fair. You know,
you weren't sufficiently informed at the time that this kind of personal dilemma of ego is common to all writers, and that this kind of informed the mistake you made with this infidelity.
Well, I just think, you know, I first of all, I think writers, if they can at all control it, should never go to a book fair. You know, it's just too disturbing to see how many books there are in the world. And then you also question yourself, sort of like, who am I to add another book to the pile? You know, like some impermanent, you know, particularly now that with the way publishing works, you know, books, they essentially have a life of about 4 to 5 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, then they're no longer in a lot of bookstores, or if they are in bookstores, they're somewhere on a high shelf where nobody sees them. Granted, there's Amazon and other internet places, so people can find books whenever you want. But in a very real way, it's like the book fair again. It's just like so much product. How do you make yours stand out?
On the other hand, I mean, we were talking about blurbs earlier and how this is kind of an inherently silly enterprise to a large degree. I mean, why couldn't you just not take any of this kind of thing seriously? I mean, especially with the massive towers or the flamboyant effusiveness of money and so forth. I mean, it's not something you can really take seriously. I mean, why do you think that you confused the business with books with the artistic stature of books?
Well, you know, I think you're right. It was, and it is a real confusion. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact of just living in New York City when you're so close to the publishing industry itself. You know, I think it's very unhealthy for a writer to live here.
Yeah.
And I'm actually not so sure how much really great writing is being done in New York right now. So I do think, you know, when you live in New York and you're close to the industry, that you can kind of give it too much importance and give it too much credence, and when you do that, you kind of give it too much power. You know, the smartest thing, it seems to me, is to sort of live your life however and wherever you want to live it, do your work, and then find a way to publish. And kind of the great thing, one of the very great things about the way the way the literary world works now is it doesn't matter if you publish with Random House or with Melville House or with, you know, Akashic Books. I mean, it's a completely level playing field. It isn't in terms of sort of marketing and placement in bookstores, but you know what? You actually don't need that anymore. You know, everything has been completely leveled. And so, you know, places like McSweeney's and places like Grey Wolf, they're publishing really, really amazing books that are getting just as much attention, if not more so, than these kind of big behemoths. So the behemoths are on their way out.
All that said, however, if you say that New York is debilitating to you as a writer, and we've established the last 4 or 5 years, fiction-wise, has been difficult for you, you know, why be in New York? I mean, have you pretty much thrown your hat out of the ring, or collected your hat from the ring, in terms of fiction, or?
No. My next book's going to be a novel, so I'm definitely going to be writing fiction again. Just sort of practical reasons, family. You know, my son's here, and I think if he weren't, then I probably wouldn't live here.
Yeah.
I mean, other than, you know, I've got wonderful friends here, and there's things I love about it, but I do think it's just, you know, Brooklyn's become the second most expensive place to live in the country now.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. So, you reprint a celebrity journalist's Facebook messages concerning the Coinstar machines. Sounds like a plan, but I've never seen one in NYC. Anybody around here know if such a thing exists in the Big A?
Mm-hmm.
So, this kind of reveals not only your humiliation and your envy, but about how these Coinstar machines, they're an increasingly common experience in your life.
Uh-huh.
But it also sort of shows this disparity between public and private impression, and
that
idea of the author's role to society cuts both ways. You know, and then, of course, there's the bank with the dog dish outside and so forth. You know, what do you think taking another person's words in another medium does for the medium, I suppose, of memoir, if we can even call it a medium or a genre, I suppose, of memoir. Do you think that that allowed you to sort of hone your own experiences so it wasn't just some sort of straight shot confessional writing? I mean, how did that provide context for you or an anchor your own experience?
Well, I think that memoir, the novel too, but memoir is one of these forms that really to be done with as much depth as you can do it. You know, you really need to. You can't say, "Oh, I'm not going to put that Facebook post in there." I mean, there's certain, you know, there are things in life that are relatively new. Like our relationship to Facebook, our relationship to Twitter.
Yeah. Well, you're very hostile to technology in this, and yet you're also succumbing to it.
But I think that, you know, it's one of your responsibilities as a writer is to come to terms with all of these new things that are in our lives. And so by posting the Facebook, by including the Facebook posts, I really just wanted to write about that, the experience of sitting there, which, you know, most of us have had now. They're on Facebook, sitting there, following a thread on Facebook, feeling weirdly envious of this person who has this, like, jar of change.
Yeah.
And yet you're alone on this computer in your life, and there's somebody else over there in their life, and they're doing a public post, which purports to tell you something private, but it could actually just be a performance, like you don't know.
Yeah.
So I wanted to try to sort of get into that whole experience that we have now.
Well, while we're on the
trying to trying to navigate Facebook posts, I mean, come on.
Yes.
You have to be pretty savvy to do it.
Yes. No, I think what we're getting at here with the Coinstar stuff is that in order for you to write truthfully or even acceptably or comfortably about your own humiliation, you require a little bit of reflection that Facebook lacks, and yet you also require the need to understand the Facebook stuff so that you can actually so that you can actually wrestle with this issue in our culture.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, that that's what books provide, and it doesn't matter whether it's a novel or a memoir or a book of poems or a book of, you know, creative nonfiction or whatever. It's just that's what's so special about. Again, I'm going to say the two covers of a book. It could also be an e-book. I don't know.
Yeah.
People like reading e-books.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to me that Kindles actually kind of have a cover.
You know, people still demand that physicality.
Sort of like
yeah.
sort of faux cover, you know?
Yeah.
You still sort of feel like you need to open something. But I feel like what happens between the covers of a book is very special. It's a very kind of privileged space where you're required to reflect. I mean, books that don't reflect are useless.
Yeah.
You know? They're completely useless. They're just product. And there are plenty of books that don't reflect. They just sort of, like, show.
Yeah.
But I did feel like because I was writing a book, and, you know, frankly, a lot of this book I actually did write in longhand before I got too consumed with it and then started going back to the computer again. You know, I was doing it at a different speed. It was just a piece of paper and a pen, and I was writing about things that happened at a much different speed, so that did allow me to reflect.
Do you think, though, that notion of reflection or the ability to work at that slower speed, is that's still going to hold even with whatever technological advances we see in the next 10 years, which could even be worse than the last 10 years?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, storytelling has survived, you know, at least a couple of millennia already. And all the technological changes that have happened during those couple of millennia, and I can't imagine that there's going to be any kind of technological innovation that will really change it anymore. I mean, obviously the way we get stories has changed an awful lot. You know, we can carry them around on our phones.
Yes.
And sort of the form they take changes too, but the thing itself will never change.
Yeah. So, I presume that in the case of the nominee and Marina, you didn't clear their appearances in the book with them. The question I have is, you know...
Oh, yes, I did.
You did? Oh, really?
Yeah, and their legal counsel.
Oh, really? Wow. So, the nominee and Marina, and I know... And wow. So, did you have to actually omit anything, or...?
There were some, you know, and I had an attorney. I had an attorney, a media attorney, read the book too, and there were some things that I omitted, just for privacy issues, which I was frankly happy to do.
Yeah.
And there were some things that I omitted, just because they would make life harder. You know, I have an ongoing relationship with Marina, the nominee. You know, we're raising a child together.
Yeah.
So it's important for us to have a good working relationship. So. You know, while they may not ever be happy with the book, I think they're happier with the version of it now than earlier versions, which were much more vindictive. And frankly, I was happy. Frankly, wow. I was happy to have the chance to try to be a little bigger about it.
But it's fairly scathing, that letter to the nominee, as it stands right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Some people are really not into that letter, which seems strange to me.
Yeah.
You know. Even Dwight Garner at the time said it was a mistake, but I sort of feel like it's funny, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like people who feel it's a mistake are losing sight of the fact that it's taking something that's incredibly hard and even sort of agonizing and making and turning it so it's comic, you know?
Yeah.
So
I presume by saying some people have thought that letter was a mistake, I think we're talking about Dwight Garner, really. Yeah. I want to actually ask you about this. I mean, he suggested that the many asides in your declaration, I am taking my prize, but this is not the way that prize takers talk. So, you know, I have to ask to answer his criticisms. What did writing and publishing that letter give to you? And it seems to me that there's another separate side issue in your last answer, because they've actually seen another version of that letter, which is even more extreme, which creates an even more intricate reception and dynamic here. So, you know, let's talk about this. I mean, why, what did that do for you? I mean, it seems to me on one hand it's a cathartic release, but it seems to me that there might also be something more to that act.
Well, one of the things the book charts is just this whole idea of trying no longer to be too good to be true and trying just to be true.
Yeah.
And so I think that letter contains a lot of thoughts and feelings that I had over the years that I never gave voice to, that I wouldn't even admit to myself. And so there was this cathartic part of literally just writing it down. And I still remember, I kind of stayed up all night writing the first draft of that letter.
Yeah. Not much reflection in that letter.
No, there's not. And then the choice after you write it, and I felt like really exhilarated afterwards. I mean, I kind of walked around the apartment. I wanted to high five everybody, you know. But then the question afterwards becomes, okay, I've had this wonderful writing experience. Does it go in a drawer or does it stay in the book? And then I felt like, because part of what the book dramatizes is this whole process of no longer being too good to be true and just being true, that the letter had a kind of crucial role. Probably even more so than the moment when I take all my bills out of the places where I've been hiding them and then show them to Eliza, my girlfriend. Probably even more than that. It's just sort of the moment when I kind of let it all out. It's the howl, you know. It's the scream.
Yeah, I'm blanking on the Muhammad Ali quote about bragging and boasting. It's very early in the morning, but to sort of tie that into the prize winning aspect, I think it ain't no brag if you, I'm totally butchering it, but it's like ain't no brag if you've got it, the talent. Muhammad Ali fans who are listening to this, I apologize. I am so dead right now. But respond specifically to the prize winning aspect, I mean, how does this make you a prize winner, this particular?
Well, I was just riffing off the idea of, you know, the nominee who was nominated for a prize.
Yes.
The idea was that I was one-upping him by writing this letter, you know, that sure, you got your nomination, but now I'm taking my prize. So there is a boasting quality to it. You know, it's interesting. My brother-in-law is a curator named Bennett Simpson. Who works at LA Mocha, and he just did a big show. He just mounted this really big show called Blues for Smoke.
Yeah.
And I read a big interview with him yesterday where he was talking about the kind of the blues and what it is, and how it's this kind of shape shifting. You know, you take the set of circumstances, which can be really trying and really awful, and then you kind of redeem them by talking about them specifically, by being very specific about kind of what your malady is, you know.
Yeah.
And so I do think there's a sense that this book is a kind of work of the blues, you know. It's kind of take your life, the very real circumstances of your life, and try to turn them to something else. And in this case of the nominee letter, There is something very immediate about it. I think Dwight's wrong when he says this is not how prize winners talk. You know, now I'm lost.
maybe a way of also looking at the issue is this. You know, you said just now, well, you have to have reflections of the essential quality of writing.
Uh-huh.
You also just said that the letter itself was not written with reflection in mind. So how is this
it's wrapped up in an entire structure,
yeah.
You know? An entire structure of the book shows the kind of reflection that I'm talking about. There are moments within it which are going to be much more kind of a pure expression of dissatisfaction. Or in that sense, like I said, like that chapter is just a kind of howl of grief and of anger and of retribution. But it's wrapped up into something else, you know? It plays a role in a narrative progression. And there are other chapters which have a completely different way of operating that involve a lot more reflection. I mean, there's the last chapter, which is just... I'm never going to be able to read that chapter aloud ever because I'll just burst into tears. You know, even now when I look at it, I get all teary. So I think if you think about the book as a whole, the reflection is still kind of wrapped into it, even if individual sections are performing different things.
We talked earlier about what you had to omit because of legal. Mm-hmm. What did you have to omit just from a strictly personal level? I mean, what things could you not really broach in this book?
You know, I don't think there's anything that I couldn't broach. There's things that I didn't want to write about. I mean, I didn't really want to write about sex.
Yeah.
That's my resistance. You know, I had sort of well thought out or clearly thought out ideas about that. I thought that, you know, like, well, the sex taboo is over. Everybody can write about sex. You can make pornos on your phone.
Yeah.
Money is the real taboo now, so I'm going to write about money instead of sex.
Uh-huh.
So it was a very conscious choice.
Yeah.
You know, that the sort of closest to the bone writing in this book was going to be about money. It wasn't going to be about sex. It wasn't going to be about love. It wasn't even going to be about infidelity. It was going to be about money. So a lot of that was a sort of conscious choice of what I was going to include and what I was going to leave out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, money.
Wasn't really anything I didn't want to include.
Yeah.
Other than kind of the, you know, the real intimate life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of which, I mean, you have Eliza constantly say, "Tell me that this is over." These constant encouragements to, hey, Ben, get your ass off the ground and get that. I mean, it really is a very intriguing masculine stigma right now. The idea, I mean, there's so many unemployed men out of work.
Right.
And weirdly enough, only women seem to be allowed to talk about this. Why do you think that there is that stigma? And do you think that using the Trojan horse of literature is really the way to talk about these issues? That the only way we can break that stigma is through approaching it from a sideways angle, along the lines of memoir or literature and so forth.
I think that, you know, I think memoir is more immediate and kind of happens faster. You know, I'm quite sure people are working on novels right now that are about this very thing, but novels take time, you know. So I think that, you know, nonfiction might be the place where we're sort of playing these things out. You know, there's The End of Men and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm sure some novels have already been written and published that kind of deal with this. But I think, you know, the big novel about the relationship where the man kind of loses his agency and then the woman is out in the world operating the way men used to. I think that novel's probably being written right now somewhere.
You could write that novel. You know.
It's true. It's true, I could.
Have you had any... if you're willing to take on these very personal subjects in memoir form, I mean, why not reapproach them in fiction or even use fiction to weave certain half-truths into truths, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the novel that I've been thinking about and sort of planning isn't really about that or set in this world, but you know, I could see writing a short story for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe I should.
Oh, yeah, I want to also talk about this image of you constantly looking at the Manhattan skyline, the towers, uh-huh, and all the Fitzgeraldian uh-huh moment. Uh-huh. At the end of the book, we get some indication that you may have reconciled with that or may have not. What is the allure of the Manhattan skyline now in this more, I guess, truthful and humbling mode of being a fact checker these days?
Well, it's funny, you know, the Manhattan skyline now is much less it's much less of a monolith. I mean, you have that new tower,
yes,
in downtown, you know, at Ground Zero that's rising, that's unfinished. So now when I look at the Manhattan skyline, I think of, you know, I see that tower. I see that kind of rebuilding, and I still, you know, it's hard not to think of that wound down at Ground Zero. And so I think the Manhattan skyline now really kind of reflects this whole kind of rebuilding that's going on. And certainly when I look at it and I try to find some kind of personal resonance with it, as we all do,
yeah.
You know, to me, in a way, it sort of does reflect what's happening, which is sort of like rebuilding from this horrible calamity. I mean, I remember 9/11 so vividly. It was right before... I left for Italy, and my ex-wife and I almost didn't leave for Italy. We had planned on leaving for Italy to go away. We almost didn't leave just because we didn't want to leave New York City after that. But that whole experience is very much wrapped up into New York City for me.
Yeah. But the physical devastation would seem to me a very effective way. I mean, the upside of physical devastation is that it allows you to confront personal devastation. Yeah, so I suppose, are you going to need more of that in your life? Do we need more potholes in the streets? And complete.
But, you know, as I say at the end of the last chapter, New York is one of these cities where everything's constantly being knocked down and rebuilt again. And everywhere you go, there are these weird blocks where you just have those blue plywood walls, and there's a huge hole on the other side because something has been knocked down and something bigger is going up. The place is constantly being reinvented, constantly being remade, and that's where all the noise comes from. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that, and that's a very real way in which the remaking of the city really reflects sort of the remaking of our lives.
On that note of revision and remaking, Ben, it was a pleasure to tap. Thanks so much.
Great, thank you,
everyone. Fantastic.